Okay, today I'm going to talk about chapter 9, which I'll be handing out to you right now. And this is about using everything we've done so far to compute compute custodial modular forms in general. And in a somewhat more intelligent manner than things I may have mentioned before. Sure. There was a question about the length and level and so on for the projects that you're doing. And let me try to clarify what I want there. The intended audience of your project is not me. It's other people in this class. The intended level of the presentation should be that it's aimed at the other people in this class. And the length, you should think of it as being like one of the medium to longer sections of the book, okay? So it could be, written in a style. Just imagine that you're almost writing a section for the book. It won't be a section of the book, but imagine that you're writing a section for the book. That'll help you aim the intended level and length and so on. So it could be, 5 pages, and it assumes background similar to what's assumed in the book, which is a number of standard first-year graduate courses in things like complex analysis. Okay, does that help answer your questions? Okay, any other questions about projects at this point? Okay. The first section in chapter 9 is something that I think I've already done kind of informally in lecture, and that's just a statement that MK gamma 1 of n, space of modular forms of weight k for the group gamma 1 of n, decomposes canonically as a direct sum over Dirichlet characters epsilon mod n. Subspaces MK and epsilon. And not sure if I should say anything more. I think I've done this already once or twice. So, is that right? I feel like you know why this is true. Somebody tell me why this is true as a test to see if you remember what's going on here. Just to sort of refresh your memory, since you're not instantly knowing, I should probably at least sketch why it's true. The group gamma 1 of n sits inside of gamma 0 of n as a subgroup. And the quotient group is z mod n z star. And moreover, gamma 1 of n is a normal subgroup of gamma 0 of n. And that means that if you just look at the definitions, that this quotient group z mod n z star acts on mk gamma 1 of n. And then this is just a direct sum decomposition of a representation of a finite abelian group as a direct sum corresponding to each of the characters of that finite abelian group. Okay? So that's what this decomposition is. And the reason that's mentioned in section 9.1 is that in order to compute this space, it's much better to compute, in most cases, each of these individual spaces. Especially because the main reason in which you want to compute a space of modular forms is in order to find the common eigenvectors for all the Heck operators. And it turns out that the common eigenvectors for all the Heck operators, as I'll explain a little later, all lie in individual factors like this. So if you have an element of mk gamma 1 of n, and it's an eigenvector for every single Heck operator, it's a fact that it will indeed live in one of these subspaces. So you're going to end up having to, if you really want to compute with these. If you're going to find all the eigenvectors in here, you don't lose anything by passing to one of these subspaces, because all of your eigenvectors will live in these subspaces. Okay. Let's see. One other thing that I didn't explain yet that's in section 9.1 is that there are operators called diamond bracket operators, diamond brackets D, that these operate on NK gamma 1 of n. And you have one of these for each d, for each integer d, with the GCD d in capital N equal to 1. And this operator is just by definition, you take d and consider it modulo n, and that's the operator you get here. And if you unwind the definitions, here's what it is completely explicitly. You choose any matrix at all of G equals, well, G in SL2Z such that G is congruent to the diagonal matrix D inverse 0, 0, D. N. And you can do this because D is coprime to N. So D inverse, well, this just means, this literally means D inverse modulo N. So it means some integer that's congruent to D inverse mod N. So maybe I should write it down. So this D inverse mod N is something. So this matrix, it'll have determinant 1 modulo N, and hence you can lift it to an element of SL2Z, the 2x2 matrix with determinant 1 mod n. So you can plot such a matrix, and then diagonal brackets D on a modular form F is just F bar this matrix G, the bar K action of that matrix G, which you might remember from much earlier in the course. So that's what it does, and it doesn't depend on the choice, because if you choose a different matrix with this congruence condition, you'll just be changing by an element of gamma 1 of n, and that doesn't affect the action, because f is gamma 1 of n invariant. So that's the definition of diamond brackets T. On nk gamma 1 of n, the Heck operator satisfies certain recurrence. So it's the TP to the R satisfy TP to the R equals TP to the R minus 1 times TP minus diamond brackets P, P to the R minus, or P to the K minus 2, T sub P to the R minus 2.
Should I remember that correctly?
And here this is only for, this is TP for P coprime to the level. It also works for P dividing the level if you define this to be zero, diamond brackets, P for P dividing the level to be zero. So you have this recurrence, and just a nice observation, if you just set R equal to 2 here, is that T sub P squared equals T sub P the whole thing squared minus diamond brackets P, P to the K minus 2, and then T sub P to the 0 is the identity matrix. And that tells you that diamond brackets P is an element of a Heck algebra, at least tensored with Q. Which means that if you have something that, if you take the diamond bracket operators and break up the space, you won't have broken it up any more than you would have done just using the Heck operators. Because in fact, every diamond brackets operator is a linear combination of Heck operators. If you just solve this equation, you see that. It's in fact true that the diamond bracket operators are in the Heck algebra even without tensoring with Q. And that's one of the exercises I put here. And the way you solve it is you use Dirichlet's theorem on primes in arithmetic progression. If you consider this relation for one prime, it doesn't quite give it to you, because notice you have this P in the denominator. But you can find a prime Q that's congruent to P mod N. In fact, there are infinitely many by Dirichlet's theorem, but if there exists at least one, and then diamond brackets Q is equal to diamond brackets P. And using exactly the same argument, you find that diamond brackets Q is also in the Heck algebra, but with a denominator involving only Q. And if you think in terms of matrices, if you have an integer, if you have a matrix of rational entries, and it only has P in the denominator, and it only has Q in the denominator, it has to have only integer entries. Alternatively, you can write appropriate powers of P and Q, some linear combination of them as one, and then you take a linear combination, you get this directly. But in any case, it's in fact the case that the diamond brackets P is in T sub Z. But that's completely an aside, and we won't need that. But people, it's kind of funny because you really need Dirichlet's theorem to prove it. And it's really sort of strange that something that difficult is required in order to prove something that seems very basic about Heck operators. But I don't know any other argument besides that. I don't know if you, Ralph, do you know any other argument? Okay, well, the fact that the diamond bracket operators are in the Heck algebra.
Yeah. That was a good. So it's not in the finite order.
That's right.
In the units.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right, because it order divides the order of this finite group. Which, for example, implies it's diagonalizable, which is what you use to get this direct sum decomposition. Okay, so back to computing modular forms. So now I'm going to tell you a beautiful structure theorem for MK gamma 1 of N that's due to Atkin, Lehner, and Winnie V. It's really one of those basic structure theorems in the theory of modular forms. It's really, really important. The proof is something I'll admit, though I will give you, I think, a very short but clean idea of why it's true. And the proof is readable, but geez, it's pretty technical to go through it. I went through it in a course once. It's just a much more interesting, refined decomposition theorem than what I just gave you here. It gives you a much cleaner and more complete decomposition. It's for SK rather than MK. Remember, MK is SK direct sum EK. And EK, you understand pretty well because you can write down a basis of eigenvectors and you know exactly where they come from. This is very explicit. So that's considered done. But SK is still pretty mysterious. And what this is going to give, and I'll explain in detail in a minute, it's going to give a nice direct sum decomposition of this in terms of simpler pieces. That's more refined, or that's compatible with this decomposition over here. And it's actually also, there's something similar for SK and epsilon, for any epsilon, and hence in particular for SK gamma 0 of N. So it's a theorem, really it was proved first by Atkin and Lehner about SK gamma 0 of N. And if you don't know who Atkin and Lehner are, I don't know too much about Lehner, but I've met Atkin and talked to him a few times. And he's this guy who did a huge amount of computation with modular forms back in the 60s and the 70s on very hard to program computers. So he would write some interesting code related to modular forms or number theory, and then they would run it on maybe one of the first calculations they would run on the new computer, and some new computer that takes up a whole room, and then they would find some subtle bug in the computer using his code to compute something about modular forms. I think there's a really nice volume devoted to him. I think Birch wrote something about him being one of your nightmare sort of colleagues who does incredibly important work that is that is very important because you hear about it from other people at conferences, but he doesn't publish very much or publishes very little because it's hard to publish the sort of things he does since they're often just calculations, even though they're really hard to do. So he's sort of a nightmare colleague because you want to support him, but how do you support him given that he's just doing calculations that turn out to be really important to a lot of other people's work, but they're hard to publish in and of themselves. In any case, with later they proved a structure theorem for SK gamma zero n, and they needed it in order to really understand in a deeper way how to compute with this space. Birch describes that the paper that Atkin later wrote where they described the structure of the space better as finally making this abstract space of modular form, something concrete and explicit that you can work with using a computer. So, and then Winnie Lee, who's at Penn State, she wrote a PhD thesis with Andrew Ogg, and her thesis was to generalize the work of Atkin and Lehner from SK gamma zero then to SK gamma one then. So that was Winnie Lee's input to this. And of course, it also works with these subspaces. Winnie Lee actually generalized it even more, not just to gamma 1 event, but to other congruent subgroups that are even more complicated, that are kind of like analogs of gamma 1 event, but where you put the one in the upper right instead of the lower left, that sort of thing. So she really generalized it as much as possible. Okay, so without further ado, let me tell you what these people proved. So first, consider two spaces of modular forms, SKM and SKN. And let's assume that here this could be gamma 0 of M and gamma 0 of N, or gamma 1 of M and gamma 1 of N, doesn't matter. Assume that M divides N. Then there's a relationship between the two of these. So I'll put gamma 1 of N. So there's a relation between the two if you have a divisibility. One's a subset of the other, for starters, because the condition to be an element of SK gamma 1 of M means that your function on the upper half plane is invariant under the action of every single element of gamma 1 of M. And if M divides N, then gamma 1 of M is contained in gamma 1 of N. Sorry, I said that backwards. Gamma 1 of N contained in gamma 1 of M, just because M imposes a stronger congruence condition than N. If you're congruent to 1 modulo M, then you're certainly congruent to 1 modulo N. So if an element is invariant under all of gamma 1 of M, it's automatically invariant under all of gamma 1 of N. So literally, as sets even, SK gamma 1 of M is contained in SK gamma 1 of N. But there are actually a number of different ways of mapping. In a natural way, there's a whole bunch of what are called degeneracy maps from the left to the right. Then you have one of them, delta t.
What do I call it? Delta? I might call it alpha here.
Alpha d.
Yeah, I call it alpha. Thanks.
So you have one alpha t for every single divisor of t of n divided by m. And this map alpha t is simply, when t equals 1, it's just the identity map. But in general, alpha t sends f of q to f of q to the power of t. And this is, for any t that divides n over m, it's pretty easy to see that this is a modular form here. So it's certainly easy to see when t equals 1. That's what I just explained to you. But it's also true when t is bigger than 1. And leave that as an exercise.
And by the way, the homework that's due this Wednesday, I think I made that pretty clear on Friday what it is in the handout. And the homework I'm going to assign this Wednesday is going to be, I'm going to give you a complete printout of the book, And by the following Monday, since the book is due on Wednesday, you're going to hopefully give me some feedback, if I'm lucky, on at least some part of the book.
So that will, you just have to sit down at a coffee shop and scribble some notes all over it, and that will be your homework. It's not impossibly hard, you just have to be critical. But no, this statement is, it should be an exercise. Okay, so for each divisor of N over N, we have a map like this. And I'm just going to, I'll use those to show you some extra structure that you might not know about. I'm not sure if it works. So just these definitions were a part of the accomplishment of Abkin and later, about a week. There's a really important subspace of SK gamma 1 of n called the new subspace, and it can be defined in a number of different ways. So first of all, define the old subspace, because that's pretty easy to define given what I've shown you already. It's probably the easiest of all spaces to define given what I've given. SK gamma 1 of n old, that's simply the sum of the images of all these maps for all m divided n. So it's the vector space spanned by images of all those maps, where m has to strictly divide n, otherwise you wouldn't get anything interesting. So it's the sum of alpha t of sk gamma 1 of m, where m is the divisors of n, m not equal to n, so proper divisors, and t runs to the divisors of n divided by m. So that's the old subspace. It's a subspace of Sk gamma 1 of n. And it's stable under the action of all of the Heck operators. So that's not obvious. That is something that is checked, for example, in this paper of Atkin Lehner. What happens is these maps alpha t, they don't have to, so each of these is a module over the Heck algebra. So if you just consider, say, the polynomial ring in infinitely many variables t sub n, then this is acted on via Heck operators, via that polynomial ring t. Each of these is a module over t. This map need not preserve the action of the Heck operators. It's not a Heck-a-module homomorphism. However, if you, for one, if you restrict only to Heck operators t sub n with or T sub P, say, with P not dividing capital N, then it does respect the action of those. So if you consider the subring of T, T prime, where T prime is generated by the Heck operators co prime to the level, the anemic Heck algebra again, so if P doesn't divide the level, the anemic Heck algebra, then this is a T prime module homomorphism. Also, if you have an element here and you map it over, and then you apply a TP for P dividing the level, you get something that's in the images map in the image of one of these maps. It's just that the T might get replaced by something else. So, despite these maps alpha T not being capital T module homomorphisms. And even though they're, I mean, it's nice that they're T prime module homomorphisms, but what is true is that some of the images of the alpha T's all discorded get permuted around by the TP, even for P dividing the level. So this image, when you take the sum of everything together, this is preserved all together as a module over T, so it's a T module. Even though the individual summons need not be T modules. Okay? Now, I'm not explaining the details of why that is, but it is in fact true. So this is the old subspace. I haven't defined the new subspace yet. We have this old subspace. The new subspace of cusp-forms is there are a couple of ways to define it. See, there really, I guess, three different ways to define it. One definition I can give without having to say anything more that I haven't said already, but it's kind of a hard, possibly a hard definition to swallow, but SK gamma 1 of N is a module over the Heck algebra. I just described for you a submodule, the old submodule. The new submodule is the largest Heck-a-stable submodule that doesn't intersect this. So that completely characterizes some other submodule of SK gamma 1 of N. It's the biggest one, so that the sum of the two is SK gamma 1 of N, and they have trivial intersection. But it's not, of course, clear that such a thing even exists. So that's not a very good definition. Yeah, that's why it's not a good definition. It's not even clear it defines the thing. It's not clear the definition is well defined. It does, in fact, define it, though. There's a unique one that that works. There's a unique largest submodule that's Heck equivariant. That's the crucial thing. And you can have lots and lots of different. I mean, it's just, you just view this as a vector space, and this is a subspace. Of course, there are lots of other subspaces, so that the sum of the two is the whole thing. The crucial thing is the requirement that this is also stable under the Heck operators. And that does uniquely determine it, but it's not a very good definition. An alternative definition, which is, so this is an alternative definition, or definition two, I just gave you definition one, which isn't very good. Definition two is, there's an inner product on here called the Petersen inner product. And the new subspace is the orthogonal complement of the old subspace under that inner product. That definition isn't so good because I have to define the Petersen inner product for you and prove that it behaves well with respect to the Heck operators. So that's unsatisfactory definition two. Now for unsatisfactory definition three. For each of these maps going this way, there's a map in the other direction called beta t, which goes in the other direction. The composition of the two maps is multiplication by a scalar, which you can work out, a non-zero scalar. So basically, they have sections, if you like, or maybe alpha t are sections of a certain map. But each of these maps, they have a corresponding map going in the other direction. The corresponding map is basically a trace map. You have something that's invariant under the smaller group, and you can do some sum over cosets of one group and the other in an appropriate manner, and you get something that's invariant into the other group. And you can write it down completely explicitly. The formulas, though, aren't nearly as nice as this. But there are maps in the other direction that complement these maps. And then the new subspace is the intersection of the kernel. It's the intersection over all m dividing n, m not equal to n, and t dividing n over n. It's exactly the same set as over here. Of the kernel of beta t. So if you take the intersection of all those kernels, you get the new subspace. And these maps, again, going in the other direction, are not Heck equivariant, but they're almost Heck equivariant. They're at least Heck equivariant for the anemic Heck algebra, they're invariant. That is, they're T prime module homomorphisms. And moreover, the when you consider Heck operators that divide the level, the kernels of these maps are preserved at least. So, is that right? No, it's just that the sum of the kernels is preserved. So the kernels could get moved around, but the sum of the kernels is preserved. So you have maps in both directions that complement one another. So it's three unsatisfactory definitions of the new subspace. So hopefully you'll like one of them. For computations, really this is the nice one to use. And for computations, instead of working with modular forms, as you might guess, you work with modular symbols. And then it's kind of nice because when you dualize everything to work with modular symbols, the easy definition and the easy one to work with is the map going down, because you dualize this picture, so somehow the easy one to define going up here is the corresponds to the easy one to define on modular symbols, which is going from higher level to lower level. But
okay, so there is a special subspace defined by Atkin and Lehner called the new subspace of SK gamma 1 n. And it's alternatively the complement of the images of all of those, the biggest one, the Tekka stable, or the complement with respect to a certain inner product, or the intersection of the kernels of maps going from higher level to lower level. So probably you're used to getting maybe one incomplete definition, but now I'm giving you three incomplete definitions. So I hope you won't find it too annoying. Now, here's the theorem that Atkin and Lehner prove. And also the gamma 1 case, and much more generally. I'll state it twice. So they prove that SK gamma 1 of n is a direct sum over all integers n dividing n. And all t dividing n over m of alpha t of sk gamma 1 of m nu. And likewise, a little subtlety here, sk and epsilon, the epsilon piece of sk gamma 1 of n, is the direct sum over n dividing n, t dividing n over m. Now you have to constrain the m. We require that m is divisible by the conductor. Alpha t Sk m and epsilon prime. It's just epsilon, since the conductor of epsilon divides n, there's a unique character mod n that you get from epsilon just by restricting or viewing epsilon as a character mod n. And then new again. Okay, so now let's just look at this for a minute. So, I mean, it's an incredibly important theorem because it says that if you want to understand SK gamma 1 of n, at least as a T prime module, so all these decompositions are as T prime modules. It's true for as long as you avoid hack operators dividing the level. If you want to understand this, all you have to do is understand, at least for certain problems, the new subspaces for levels dividing capital N. I mean, that's pretty amazing because the new subspaces, as the second part of the theorem will tell you in a minute, have also a very nice surprising structure, as we'll see in a second. But first, already it says that you can restrict to new subspaces, which are much, in some ways, much easier to understand than the whole space. So if you understand all these new subspaces, then you get the entire space here. And exactly on the nibs. So the thing is, with this you can have all kinds of, the images can intersect in all kinds of ways. This tells you that if you take the image of new forms of any level dividing n, and for a given t, that has zero intersection with all the other images for other m's or other t's. And moreover, you get absolutely everything by adding these all together. you get the new forms, because that's one of the things that's included here, but then you also get everything else, just from new forms, out of level divided global. In other words, all the old forms are in fact new forms of some lower level. That's what this says. And here, it's just the same statement for the subspace given by a given character. So in other words, if you take this and break it up as a direct sum, sk and epsilon, then each of these sk and epsilon get broken up by new subspaces of levels that are divisors of levels of n. I mean, divisors of n. There is this one condition, I remember when I learned about it, so I missed it when I first implemented a program for computing modular forms. So I just neglected to include this condition, and I did something silly with the character when m didn't divide, when its conductor didn't divide m. So I had, say, a character of conductor, some number, and then I included levels even when the character's conductor didn't divide that level. So, I mean, it doesn't really make sense to get a character there, but in some way in my program did it anyways. I was getting wrong answers, and it took me a long time to find out, to figure out why I was getting a decomposition of this space, and this sum wasn't direct, and I was getting things from here that weren't supposed to be in here, and so on. But Kevin Buzzard again saw me in the computer lab and helped me figure out what the condition was. So that's an important condition to include. Okay, so yes, please.
Are you settling over the conductor's E prime here, or is it?
Epsilon's fixed, and by epsilon prime, I mean the following. So epsilon is a homomorphism from Z mod NZ star to C star. The fact that the conductor of epsilon divides M means that, means that this homomorphism factors through like this.
Okay.
And by epsilon prime, I mean any homomorphism that you put there. So thanks for clarifying that. And if M wasn't divisible by the conductor, there wouldn't be any way to factor through like this. It wouldn't even make sense to write down a character there. Nonetheless, I, as a grad student, did that anyways. I got myself in all kinds of trouble. So that's the first part of the theorem. But they also prove something more, which is very important. So this calls part one of what they prove. And part two of what they prove is that this is for any n at all. And it's true for n, sk and epsilon or sk gamma 1 of n or whatever. I'll actually write it for m. Just to emphasize that it's not just for the n there, which would be silly, but this, the new subspace is a direct sum of distinct simple p prime modules. Let's see, there's p prime c modules. So just taking the Heck algebra, viewing it as being generated over the complex numbers for safety. Just viewing the matrices as being in C doesn't really change anything. But it's a direct sum of simple t prime modules, which means that just using linear algebra, you'll always be able to find a way of decomposing this as a direct sum of eigenspaces where the multiplicities of the eigenvalues all have are all 1, even just using Heck operators coprime to the level. So if you just take, say, let's just assume that 2 doesn't divide the level, t2, t3, and so on, just Heck operators t sub p, with p not dividing the level, then it's the fact that these are all diagonalizable by, I didn't explain to you, but this is a Peterson inner product. These are all diagonalizable, and their theorem is that if you find the, remember they're commuting operators, so that you can simultaneously diagonalize them. The amazing thing is that even using just the ones that are coprime to the level, you can simultaneously diagonalize them on here in such a way that the systems of eigenvalues you get are all distinct. In other words, you can distinguish any two eigenspaces
that are simultaneous eigenspaces for all of these just by looking at the system of eigenvalues. Now you might worry that possibly you'd have two elements here that are both eigenvectors that aren't, so that one isn't a scalar multiple of the other, but the eigenvalues are the same. That doesn't happen. You have absolutely complete information about this space just from the eigenvalues of these operators acting on it. Which is kind of a sort of thing you see all over in math, where you can recover a space by understanding the eigenvalues of some operator acting on it. And that's what this is saying. And it's really nice because these, this T prime, its elements all act diagonalizably on SK. And it's, these are distinct. In other words, you don't see one appearing more than once. They appear, everyone's different. Probably this is the more important of the two results.
So M just defines kappa n.
Yeah, well this is true actually. This is true independent of the first statement. It's just for any integer m at all. For any integer m. I probably should have stated it as two threads. Because it doesn't have anything to do with it doesn't have anything to do with the n statement right here. It's telling you something further about this direct sum decomposition. First, you can write this space as a direct sum like this, but moreover, each of these is a direct sum of simples where the simples are distinct. So really, it gives a lot of, it's very nice to know that.
So the new definition T prime of C, it doesn't depend on the levels.
Yeah, it doesn't depend, You could always replace it by its image in here, but no, it doesn't depend on the level. I just mean the commutative polynomial ring on infinitely many determinants.
The primes that we need to keep. So.
Yeah, on the primes, but you can But then it acts via the usual Hack algebra. Okay, so now, a really important thing is to give you a sense of why this is true. Just a little bit of a feeling for why this is true. At the bottom of page 152, I have a paragraph that I wrote right after reading the proof, which I hope in one paragraph kind of summarizes the key input to everything as far as the proofs go. So, it's really completely heuristic what I'm saying here. I won't give you a proof at all, but at least maybe it'll give you a sense of why something like that could possibly be true. The heuristic for the first part is just that at least this is the direct sum of its new and old subspace, and you have the new subspace here, and then everything else contributes to the old subspace. So somehow this part, that's the heuristic. This part, here's the heuristic for this part. This one's a little deeper in. The heuristic is the following. Suppose you had two eigenvectors, F and G, in SK gamma 1 of M. So there are two modular forms. And assume that the system of eigenvalues, that is the AP of F, that is the eigenvalue of TP acting on F. So just to make that notation clear, I'll write TP of F equals AP of F times F. And TP of G is AP of G times G. Assume that that these numbers AP of F and AP of G are the same. Assume AP of F equals AP of G for all P not dividing the levels. Okay? That's what would happen. And also assume that F is not a scalar multiple of assume that, say, F and G are normalized. I'm kind of skipping ahead a little. Basically, assume that they're not scalar multiples of each other, so they span a two-dimensional space. So that's what would happen if the simple business wasn't true. You'd have eigenspaces that have multiplicity bigger than one. This is called the Abelian multiplicity one theorem, which is used a lot if you want to understand modular forms well.
So did he do you?
What?
Knew of that plan?
Yes. Sorry. By the way, the phrase multiplicity one gets used to describe this. It's also used a lot to describe the number of times a Galois representation appears in the Jacobian of a modular curve. And there's really no relationship a priori between the two different notions. It's just that they're both called multiplicity one. So watch out for that if you end up studying modular curves. Okay, so you have two of these new forms, and they have exactly the same eigenvalues for all of the Heck operators, T sub P with P coprime to the level. What you do is you consider their difference, H, which is F minus G. Then TP of H equals 0 for all P not divided by 1. So the Heck operators, T sub P, all Hello? Yeah, can you call me back in 5 minutes? Okay, great, bye. My computer's being delivered from San Diego, so TP of H is 0 for all P not dividing M. And this implies that, let's see how to put it, this means that what happens if you consider something the image of one of these maps? So if the F starts out as some A and Q to the n, or if f is equal to sub a and q to the n, and f is an eigenvector for the Heck operators, then the eigenvalues are the a sub p, the coefficients of q to the p. If you take its image over here, and you consider only p that are coprime to the level, then what are the eigenvalues of the Heck operators? Well, it's, it's hard to prove something when it's just a heuristic. But the point is just this H has basically you should think of this like the coefficients of Q to the P are all 0 for P not dividing M. That's exactly what happens here. This thing, the coefficients, when t is not equal to 1, the coefficient of q to the p, well, certainly 0, because this is a power series in q to the t. So it's just a hint that when you have this q expansion and its coefficients has so many coefficients of 0, it probably comes from lower level. And you can make that completely precise. Which is the difference of these two, does come from lower level, but on the other hand, it's a difference of two new forms. So it's simultaneously in the new subspace and in the old subspace. The difference of f and g is simultaneously in the new subspace and the old subspace, but the intersection of those two subspaces is 0, since you have a direct sum decomposition. So f minus g has to be 0. So this is where you have to work pretty hard in your paper to get the h to 0. And then implies that f equals g. So that's just sort of the idea behind proving this multiplicity one statement. That if you have two, if the multiplicity were 2, then you have two things whose difference is
looks like it should be in the image of one of these maps, and then you prove it really is in the image of one of those maps, or at least in the sum of the images of those maps. It's kind of weird. If you look at the proofs, they just define a huge number of very clever maps between various spaces like this, and then they put them all together in a sort of very tedious manner, and they're able to use these maps and understand them well enough to make precise statements. Like, it looks like it should be an old form because of how the Heck operators act, therefore it is an old form, etc. You can get a lot of results out of this. Okay, so that's, just to finish up, that's the decomposition theorem of Acton, Lehner, and Lee for SK gamma 1 of n. Decomposes like this, and each of these pieces decompose like that. And given that cusp forms are isomorphic to modular symbols, we have exactly the same decomposition theorem for modular symbols. Modular symbols decompose like this. And you can use that, as the rest of this chapter is about, to, especially the last section of the chapter, you can use that to give a very efficient, in some ways, algorithm for writing down the systems of eigenvalues here, but on something isomorphic to this. Once you've written down the systems of eigenvalues, you'll recover the coefficients and the Q expansions of modular forms that give you each of the simple submodules. And you put those all together, and you have each of the simple submodules of this, just from systems of eigenvalues, and that gives you each of these factors. Then each of these factors gives you one of the factors of this direct sum, and taken all together, all those give you this. So to compute this space, you bust it up like this, you bust it up further like this, then you get each of these factors using modular symbols and the simplicity, and then you kind of go backwards. Okay? And I'll show you some examples and some details about linear algebra of actually getting the systems of eigenvalues on these spaces and how you store them in the computer. Because if you store them in the naive way on a power basis, each eigenvalue will take, you know, like a megabyte of space, at least in the general case when you start looking at levels around a few thousand. So, all right, so next time I'm going to talk mainly about the last section of these notes, and then we'll start on chapter 10, which will be about generating Hecke algebras over Z, and so on.